Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day, Mark Kenny here with Democracy Sausage, which comes to you each week from Australian National University. I'm from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute and the School of Politics and International Relations. And I'm talking this week with Sam Roggeveen, whose book, The Echidna Strategy, is about to be released. In fact, today, as we record this, its subtitle is Australia's Search for Power and Peace. Sam Roggeveen is director of the Lowy Institute's International Security Program. He's a former analyst with the Office of National Assessments, an expert commentator in this area, and does a lot of writing and thinking about Australia's foreign and strategic stance. So, Sam, welcome to Democracy Sausage. Really terrific to have you here, and congratulations on this new book.
Many thanks, Mark, and thanks for having me, long-time listener.
Oh, that's terrific. It's when I say congratulations on this book, it's a bold book. It's one that swims against the tide. In fact, I was thinking about this because of your name, The Echidna Strategy. Recently, Jason Clare, the education minister, had a review done of the education sector. And one of the things he instructed the reviewers to do was to come up with some spiky ideas. You come up with a spiky title,
yeah.
But it's also full of spiky ideas, and it hinges off a kind of a spiky defence doctrine in relation to Taiwan. So perhaps you could just talk to that for a moment.
Yeah, the metaphor is slightly designed to allude to what is often referred to in the context of Taiwan's defence policy, the porcupine strategy.
Mm. So you've Australianised it.
I've Australianised it, but similarly in the past, you know, the great founding leader of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, referred to Singapore as needing to be like the poison shrimp, which is to say small but too costly for any larger power to swallow. And that's really the idea here. You mentioned Jason Clare, but actually I think the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, has also referred to a porcupine strategy himself. Mm-hmm. But I actually thought at the time he mangled the metaphor slightly because he mentioned that in the context of Australia having a lot of long-range strike capabilities. But, of course, that's not what echidnas do, right? The echidna's defence strategy is basically to sit there and they do wait for an attacker to come along. But when the attacker comes along, it's very painful for that attacker. And,
right.
And that, I think, is basically the metaphor that I'm reaching for.
Yeah.
Australia doesn't need to go out in search of enemies. In fact, if you want to encapsulate the theme of the book, the argument of the book in just a couple of lines, it would be this. When it comes to China and our defence against a rising China, our single biggest defence asset is distance. You know, Beijing is closer to Berlin than it is to Sydney. We are a long way away from China. And at the moment, we're pursuing a defence policy that actually seeks to compress the distance between us and China. What we should be doing is exploiting it.
So that's kind of a new doctrine, the security of distance as distinct from the tyranny of distance,
yeah.
The security of distance. And is that based on conceiving of Australia as the, you know, the capital in Canberra and the major population centres around the east coast and the southern coast? Or is it, I mean, is what you're just saying, does that apply to Darwin as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, Darwin to China's South Sea Fleet headquarters is still around 4,000 kilometres.
Right.
I mean, it's a long, long way. And one of the things I illustrate in the book is that, you know, in the unlikely event that China should ever want to project military force against Australia, it would be a very difficult thing to do. So there's a very simple illustration of this that I use in the book. for a military commander, if their job is to hit a target and they've got, let's say, 500 kilograms of explosive to destroy a target with, if that target's over the next hill, then maybe you'll use a truck in the dead of night and you'll, you know, you detonate it from a distance. If that target's 5,000 meters away, you need artillery. If it's 500 kilometers away, you need a very expensive combat aircraft with an airfield and all those support crews and everything that goes along with it. If it's 5,000 kilometers away, you need an intercontinental ballistic missile. Now, at every step along that continuum, the costs go up exponentially, and yet the military effect that you're achieving remains constant. Mm. It's still 500 kilograms of high explosive, right? So the lesson from that is that anytime you want to project military force, there is no substitute for getting close. If you're far away, it is incredibly costly and difficult to hurt someone. And as I say, I think Australia should be exploiting that distance. And at the moment, we're pursuing a defence strategy that effectively tries to compress it by bringing our military capabilities closer to China. And that really is what at the heart of AUKUS.
Right, so it's about we perceive the threat, we project our strategic forces into that theatre or closer to that theatre, mm-hmm. and what you're saying is that in a sense that's playing into the sort of security risk problem rather than actually maximising or optimising the advantage we already have.
So the answer is yes, and there's two reasons for that. One is the kind of operational issue, which I've talked about so far, which is that it's simply much more difficult to operate at vast distance than it is close to your own shores. But I think actually the other part of this, and the part that I spend, you know, quite a bit of time on in the book, is the political problem. And that is that we would only ever operate like in the way you're suggesting, close to China's shores, you know, hemming the Chinese Navy in along its coastline, which is what these new nuclear-powered submarines are really good at doing. We would only do that together with the United States, you know, in isolation. If we had to do it alone, it would make absolutely no sense for us to be operating out there. So not only on an operational level are we pursuing, I think, a counterproductive strategy, but politically we're tying ourselves in very closely to American foreign policy and military objectives. And I don't think that's in our interest either.
Yes, and I want to come back to some of those things, but just in broader terms, I mean, you are, as I said, swimming against the tide here of a kind of a consensus, which you note either in your essay that I read in the Australian Foreign Affairs magazine or in the book, that this consensus around AUKUS, it sort of almost sort of precipitated overnight. I mean, you describe it as if you advocated nuclear submarine capability just a little bit more than a couple of years ago, you were essentially on the fringe of the debate. Then suddenly it just became the consensus.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, look, there's a charitable interpretation of how that happened, and there's a slightly less charitable one, and I think the bits of both of them are true. Here's the charitable version. Basically, it is that nuclear-powered submarines were considered to be off the table. So if you're an Australian defence commentator or you're a specialist or an academic on this issue, even if you, in theory, were in favour of Australia getting nuclear-powered submarines.
So you might have privately held that view, but it
just
didn't seem feasible.
There was no point talking about it. Yeah. Because it just wasn't feasible. And then, of course, the Morrison government asked and discovered that actually, yeah, it is feasible. We will sell you these things. Now, that gets you part of the way to an answer about how this consensus developed overnight. I think the other part of it is the less charitable version is to say that, well, generally people are very quick to gather in behind the new status, whatever the status quo is. And essentially overnight, the government announced a new status quo. First, we're not getting nuclear-powered submarines, then we are. And people tend to generally align behind the new status quo. That is a natural human tendency. But, you know, the irony here is that, you know, as you described previously, those advocating for nuclear submarines were the fringe dwellers. And now I feel like I'm a little bit on the fringe. Overnight, the status quo suddenly shifted. So, of course we're in favour of nuclear-powered submarines.
Is it also because there's a tendency, a proclivity within anyone who's within the defence community as a sort of a natural feature of it, that individuals will always look for stronger, tougher, bigger things, bigger machinery, bigger, newer technology, greater capability. When it's not feasible, that might not come up. But as soon as it is, that consensus has a sort of a default position to say yes to it. A bit like, you know, a defamation lawyer is always going to say, yeah, don't print that. That yeah, could take you to court. Well, I mean, and this goes to in a sense right to the heart of your argument, because as you've just been saying, it doesn't necessarily work that way. Yes, the capability might be increased, but it brings added risks with it.
Right. Look, certainly over the years observing the defence commentariat, I have noted in some quarters there's a certain fascination simply with the technology
with
and
kit.
The weaponry with kit. Yeah. And I know this because I recognize it in myself. I mean, I wanted to be a fighter pilot when I was a kid. And,
yes, I read
you know,
that.
My interest developed over the years into strategic studies. So I recognize it and I have a certain fascination with it as well, hopefully leavened by, you know, an understanding we should all have now as we're observing the Ukraine war of what an utter tragedy war is and how hard we should be working to prevent it at all costs. So, yes, I do recognize that tendency, but I don't think I'd put too much weight on it. I think there's enough sort of sobriety among defense decision makers that they don't, you know, that they don't get carried away by that kind of, by the romance, if you like, of weaponry. I would, though, put, I think a related point here, put a little bit more weight on what the services want. And if you put certain services in charge of decision making or you know, elevate their interests above the others, then they are in turn going to elevate their own interests.
Yeah, because there's always sort of internal competition within the defence forces between the different services. So they're looking for that kind of upper hand, looking for a better deal out of the whole thing relative to their competitors.
Indeed.
Yeah. One of the things you also studied, I read, was political philosophy. Mm. I wonder what your assessment is of how Labor so quickly moved to the position, you know, to form a critical part, arguably the critical part of this new consensus.
Yeah. Well, I heard the podcast that you did a couple of weeks ago with Frank Bongiorno and others, and I thought I haven't yet come up with a better answer to the one that was offered in that podcast, which was essentially that when Labor was given less than a day to really make up its mind about this. And then since it's come to office, it has, I think, you know, doubled down on the AUKUS deal and reinforced it with new measures. And the explanation that I heard there in that podcast I thought was a solid one, which is that at the moment there really isn't that much politically to be gained from not continuing along this line, which isn't to say that there are sort of, deep-seated divisions within the cabinet on this issue. I'm not aware of any evidence that to that effect. But at the same time, you would have to calculate politically, and I think the Prime Minister does make this calculation, if you want to be a 2 or 3 term government and you think that, and you know that the major spending on this initiative is not going to come about probably until your second or third term, then where is the upside in really in hitting the brakes on AUKUS right now? Politically, it seems to me you're just handing the opposition an issue without too much gain, potentially some gain internally, because it's clear that, as we saw from the National Conference, that there is some disquiet in ALP branches about this. But I think the naked political calculation at the moment is, well, there's not an awful lot to be gained by hitting the brakes on this right now.
Yeah, and as you say, Labor made a pretty rapid-fire decision on supporting it from opposition. Yeah. So there's a tendency to stick with that, to double down on that as having been based on a sound strategic assessment, albeit reached in a very short space of time and without a huge amount of consultation with the broader party.
Right, and I do think the speed of that decision in itself undermines the kind of arguments we've heard from Pat Conroy, for instance, about how this is AUKUS's progressive policy, for instance. And there were some
pretty reasonable arguments put forward, and I thought that was one of them. I think the other mention of appeasement in there as well was a bit strong.
Yeah, there's a reaching back into Labor history to convey the sense that this is all very deeply consistent with Labor values. But the fact that, first of all, you know, nobody that I'm aware of any seniority in the Labor Party ever spoke in favour of nuclear submarines before AUKUS was announced.
Mm.
Combine that with how quickly the decision was made to actually go along with AUKUS, and you have to question about exactly how deeply how deeply seated this belief is.
Yeah. The other thing, of course, is that Labor, and I think we covered this in that previous podcast, but Labor generally regards itself as a more vulnerable one, and there are a lot of polls bear this out, and certainly the sort of consensus in the commentariat reinforces it, perhaps even reinforces it beyond its truth. But nonetheless, that Labor has, you know, more to prove on economic management and more to prove on national security than the coalition does. Labor starts from a more suspicious position in the voter's mind and therefore has to go further. And this is one of those, or at least, you know, talk strongly and reinforce its position. And as you say, Anthony Albanese made it very openly in the National Conference that he sees the process of establishing a long-term government, as you say, two or three terms, in order to you know, really do things and then embed them in Australian society, being strong on national security is a critical thing there. So, not wanting to in any way equivocate, not to be seen to be equivocating, it's all part of that overall approach.
Yeah, and especially when you consider that financially, this AUKUS hasn't really taken off yet. You know, it's going to take several more years for the real costs to start accumulating. So at this point, there's really no budget pressure on the government to pull back either.
And that's one of the worrying things about it for me is that there's this kind of mismatch between the realities of the AUKUS coming about and the political cycle. Politicians love to announce things, things that have benefits attached to them, and there are many benefits attached in a sort of an economic sense, jobs, union jobs, as it was said at National Conference over and over, you know, regional economies bolstered by the various elements of this. So you can see the upside for a government in announcing this. The devil is always in the detail, of course, and the delivery, and there are many ways in which this can that can lead to disappointment down the track. But at the moment, there is no such downside associated with where the government is. So I suppose it goes to your original point.
Yeah, and I must say, and this is not a partisan point at all, but both sides of politics are guilty of pushing the line of, you know, defence policy as a job creator.
Yeah. Oh, it's been huge. I mean, I've come from Adelaide, right? And Adelaide has just been sort of central to this argument for so long.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think that there's possibly slightly more to be said for the related argument that we ought to have some onshore defence capabilities simply to improve our resilience against, you know, foreign interference or foreign coercion, so that we know we have enough capabilities and we're not in the situation, for instance, you know, in the worst case that the Ukrainians are now, where they have to suddenly import vast amounts of weaponry, that we can sustain ourselves if necessary. I think that has some merits on the margins, but the economic arguments, I think, are pretty weak. I mean, we're in a sub 4% unemployment economy. We're one of the strongest performing economies in the OECD over the last 30 years. The idea that we need a massive government-funded defence project in order to boost jobs in this country, I don't think passes, you know, a simple economic test. It's not like there are armies of engineers and project managers sitting on the unemployment line just waiting for the government to announce a new huge defence contract. Those people already have jobs. Most of them are in the private sector. So really what's being proposed here is that those people will now need to be attracted to taxpayer-funded jobs and moved out of the private sector. I wouldn't have thought that's a smart economic strategy.
Interesting indeed. We'll be back in just a moment.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back, Sam Roggeveen. Let's go to some of the details of AUKUS itself, because some people might have forgotten key details of it. We're talking about, I mean, the headline-grabbing things were what it was, 3 to 5 Virginia-class submarines, second-hand submarines that we would be, nuclear ones, which we would be buying from the US. They would start to come online, assuming it happens. It's one of the unknowns, of course. But assuming it happens in the early 2030s.
I think that's early to mid-2030s.
Yeah. And then there's the regular visits of a UK nuclear submarine to something called
Submarine Rotational Force West.
Yes, yeah. Right.
So one UK nuclear-powered submarine and 4 American. And we don't know a lot at the moment. We know that new facilities are going to be built at HMAS Stirling in Western Australia so that those submarines can be supported, which is to say they can be resupplied, including with weapons, mm-hmm. I believe.
Yeah.
And so that requires, you know, a different standard of equipment and facilities at HMAS Stirling, simply because these are nuclear powered vessels, and that just requires, you know, much more care and a higher level of facilities.
Yeah, right. And that is supposed to start. That Rotational Force West is supposed to start from later this decade, 2027.
Well, the phrase that I believe was used was as early as 2027. So yeah. They've given themselves some wiggle room.
Yeah, as early as, yeah. And there's also some other aspects to it. The expanded Air Force base at Tyndall, which is about, 300 km south of Darwin.
Yeah, well, no one's formally attached that to AUKUS as such.
Right.
But I think we can say it's of a piece with Australia's broader approach to its defence policy and to its alliance policy.
Right.
So, yeah, the idea there is that the facilities at the airbase at RAAF Tyndall, which is about 300 kilometres south of Darwin, that will be expanded so that you have more fuel, more accommodation and munitions stored at that airbase so that it can support up to 6 American strategic bombers, either B-52s or B-2 stealth bombers, which are, you know, very long-range aircraft.
Right. And we can talk about what that means, because you've got some interesting thoughts on that. Just before we do, I should also mention, of course, the other key thing about AUKUS is the provision of these new UK designed, or it's jointly designed and constructed UK, Australian, US SNKs, is it?
SSN, well, it's now known as SSN AUKUS.
Yeah, SSN AUKUS, yeah. That's right, yeah. And they are supposed to come online probably in the 2040s, right?
Mm. But a complete clean sheet design. In designed to get between Australia and the United Kingdom, I mean, a hugely ambitious effort. And, you know, like many people, I was shocked that we seem to be choosing the most complicated possible path towards this capability. Not only are we going to upgrade our own existing Collins-class submarines, we're then going to buy second-hand American nuclear-powered submarines, and then we're going to invest in a completely new design by UK shipyards. So 3
which don't have a great
project.
Yeah, and those UK shipyards don't have a stellar record, do they?
Mixed.
Very politely put. Let's go back to those 6 B-52s and stealth bombers and so forth. You make a really interesting point, a chilling point in a way, in the essay about how that would be seen and the capability that it gives. Now, you say that those planes would not be, it's not thought that they would be nuclear armed, that is, they wouldn't be carrying nuclear weapons, but they have a nuclear dimension. And you then go on to say it's a very, I can't remember the exact words, but it's, you know, it's a very sort of important thing to challenge another country's nuclear arsenal.
Yeah.
So can you speak to that?
Yeah, look, I mean, the first thing to say is that even if we discount the idea that these bombers could be used to target China's nuclear facilities, it is still a significant elevation of Australia's status in America's war planning for a future contingency against China. But the fact, the mere possibility that these bombers could be used, and you're quite right to say they wouldn't be nuclear armed themselves, but you can use conventional weapons to target another country's nuclear facilities.
Yeah, that's which the is critical to say, point, isn't it? Yeah.
Which is to say you target its missile silos, you target its the naval facilities that support its nuclear submarines, you destroy the command and control facilities that control that are in charge of China's nuclear force. So you can do all of that with conventional weapons.
And you might do it. I mean, I'm not saying we would or that the US would, but you might do it preemptively.
Yeah, that's possible. Yeah. I mean, I think, look, it's impossible to know the course of any such conflict, but if we have to consider, you know, the worst possible case, you would think both sides in the event, say, of a Taiwan contingency would have an interest in containing such a conflict to the conventional domain. But of course, you know, escalation can happen. And on any given day, even if the war is being contained to purely conventional measures, China doesn't know when these B-52s are approaching and they're about to fire their missiles. China doesn't know what's being targeted. China doesn't know that these bombers are tasked with hitting China's conventional forces or China's nuclear forces. So that in itself, I think, creates an incentive for China to hit first. And that's why, as I argue in the essay, I think RAAF Tyndall will be a target.
Yeah. And then there'd also be, as part of the overall, and this is part of formerly part of AUKUS, there'd also be an East Coast submarine base as well, wouldn't it?
Right. Yes. So this is a facility that the Morrison government announced and which hasn't been talked about much since. I think it's not particularly urgent. So there's a great deal of political sensitivity to it. It'll probably be in Port Kembla. That's what most, you know, pundits are predicting. It's the most suitable facility. But, you know, there's a lot of local political dramas to go through before they get the approval to build a facility like that. I mean, I lived in Wollongong. I can just imagine.
Yeah, so that's right. It's south of Sydney, sort of on the coast up north from Canberra.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you can just imagine in any city of that size what the kind of local opposition you would encounter to stationing nuclear submarines there. And once it's built, if it is ever built, then it will be the East Coast home of Australia's nuclear submarine fleet, but it will also be suited for visits by American and British submarines.
And for the same reason that Tyndall might be, it could also become a target.
Absolutely. Yes, yeah. Would be a target.
And what's the balance between the US in nuclear arsenal, warheads, for example, between the US and China at the moment?
Oh, it's highly imbalanced towards the United States. So the US nuclear arsenal is very much weighted against the Russian threat, and those two countries have roughly equal nuclear arsenals of active nuclear weapons. But China's now growing rapidly. So China, there is evidence now that China is building huge new intercontinental ballistic missile facilities to, I forget the number, but it's a very substantial expansion of its nuclear capabilities that is now in the offing.
Well, I think I saw somewhere that you, maybe from you, that it was around 400 warheads that the China has compared to the US of 1,700. Is that about right?
Yeah, that sounds roughly right, but I think China is at least doubling that figure, and I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers.
No, that's fine. It's the broad point anyway is that there's a lot of anxiety, there's a lot of development, things are changing at the moment. We're becoming involved in that change, and I think you had a very good point you made. I like the language of it. You said that what's really changed in US strategic defense terms is not force structure but force posture, and we're part of that now.
Yes. So the point I was trying to make there actually is that I think the perception is growing that the United States is taking a lot of action to counter China's rise as a military power. And that perception arises largely from American political rhetoric. I mean, ever since the Trump administration in particular, there's this sense that China is now the enemy number one for the United States. And all of its politicians say that, and it's one of the few issues that Democrats and Republicans can agree on. It's also true, of course, that the Biden administration has instituted the CHIPS Act and other things that are clearly aimed at China. But one thing it has not done, it has not actually very much increased the amount of military power it has in this region, in Asia. And you would think after a 30-year Chinese expansion, the biggest, the most dramatic that we've seen in the world since World War II, that America should have taken some dramatic action of its own by now if they were true to that rhetoric about China being enemy number one. But really what's happening is not so much that the size of the force has increased, but it's just being dispersed. And yes, as you say, Australia is part of that. We've also heard recent news of agreements with the Philippines. Papua New Guinea was a recent one, although that's a fairly modest proportions. Guam is being expanded. All of these things, I would argue, are designed to disperse America's forces around the region because China's missile threat is now so acute.
And that gives it resilience, but just by diversification, in a sense.
It gives the United States more resilience, but I think Australia would be foolish to think that it represents a reinforcement of American military power in this region. In fact, I think what it should do is force us to ask ourselves, well, how invested is the United States really in this? Does the United States really want to take on China? And are we backing the winning team here? And I'm not for a moment suggesting that, you know, we back China instead. In fact, the book is all about how Australia can protect itself and defend itself independently, much more independently than we do now. But I do fear that, you know, we're backing a team that, you know, in both scenarios, I think it looks unfavorable for Australia. Either the United States is really committed to containing China, in which case, you know, we're at risk of becoming engaged in a war alongside the United States with China, which I think would be terrible news for us. Or the other case is that the United States is not actually that committed.
Yeah, so that's a pretty chilling idea in itself, or at least it ought to be chilling on the sort of some of the rhetoric in this debate. And yet it doesn't really – I mean, there's an assumption here that what's happening is that Australia and the US and other democracies in the region are keen on containing China, that the US is projecting further power here. But you're saying that it can't be guaranteed longer term.
Well, certainly
the numbers don't actually point to that.
No, yeah. Not at all. I mean, the military balance now, for instance, on Taiwan, the military balance now I think is so heavily weighted towards China that the United States could not win a conflict like that at an acceptable cost. I mean, the United States still has the most powerful military in the world by a decent margin, but China's catching up so fast that you would have to question whether, you know, the kind of losses that the United States would suffer in a conflict like that, you would have to wonder whether the Americans would ask themselves, well, is this worth it? And I think we have reached that point, in fact.
Peter Dutton said at one point, I think while they were still in government, that it would be inconceivable for Australia not to be involved, words to that effect. Do you think that's the case, and do you think that AUKUS makes it more difficult for Australia not to be involved?
Well, I think it will, yes. I mean, you cannot build a military capability, that is to say the submarines, specifically designed, I would argue, around, you know, fighting a war in North Asia, as I said earlier, hemming the Chinese Navy in along its coastline. And potentially firing missiles onto the Chinese mainland, you cannot spend decades building a capability like that in the most intimate of embraces with the United States, both technologically, militarily, in terms of military doctrine even. You can't do that. And then on the day that the balloon goes up, suddenly say, sorry, we're not having any part in it. I mean, of course, in theory you can. And I hear people say from time to time, no, we can always say no to the Americans. Of course, theoretically, that's true, but you're making it so much harder for yourself to do that. And I think one of the problems in our national debate about Taiwan at the moment is how seamlessly Taiwan's security has come to be conflated with our own.
Yes, it is interesting, isn't it?
So,
especially when you consider the rhetoric that's been emanating from Beijing from you know, from the president and downwards, it's pretty bellicose, the language. I mean, it's pretty direct. When that invasion happens, I don't know what your feeling about the timetable of that is, But assuming it does happen, then, you know, people will be able to say, well, we were told it was going to happen. We were told it was going to happen quite soon.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you're asking me for a prediction, I won't offer one. I don't think experts on this – experts are very useful, but they're not very good at making accurate predictions. That's been well proven. So I don't buy into, you know, a lot of the discussions I hear that China has a specific date on when it proposes to retake Taiwan, and I don't think it helps very much to speculate on it. But – yeah, I do think there is a place for Australia to really question, well, you know, I mean, speaking for myself, I would very much prefer that Taiwan remains as it is now, maintains the level of independence that it has now, and that its democracy can thrive. I mean, the democracy on Taiwan is a – if nothing else, is a great affront to the Chinese Communist Party, because it signals to the world that, no, China, you're wrong about this. Your people can have democracy and can thrive under a democratic system. But if you ask me, is that a vital security interest for Australia? Then my answer is actually no. I don't think it is a vital security interest, not enough to send Australian forces to Taiwan to defend its democracy. It's a long way away, and I think Australia can survive and thrive in a world which, you know, much as we wouldn't want it, where China dominated Taiwan.
Now, we talked before about, you know, the sort of the political calculus inside Labor about some of these things. If we think back to the so-called Pacific pivot that Obama initiated, he came here, I think it's 2012, is that correct?
11, I think.
2011, and talked about that. So that was happening between a Democratic administration in the US and a Labor government here. And in some ways, these things we've been talking about are escalations on there. They're quite different, but they're nonetheless, you know, moving further in that sort of direction. Which brings me to the question – and I suppose you've made some reference to this already, but about the US's bona fides in terms of its longer-term involvement in the region, and the important question of what you think, whether you think it matters whether Trump gets a second term, which is still a possibility, amazingly, or indeed there's someone else from the Republican Party or Biden gets a second term.
I think it does matter, but maybe not as much as most people think it matters. It's important that you raise the Obama pivot from 2011, because I think it does reinforce the point that we do have reason to question whether the United States is really committed to constraining China's ambitions, because really nothing happened.
Yeah, it didn't nothing really. Much happened it didn't materialize, did it?
Yeah. So that is an important point, and actually illustrates the point that this is effectively the bipartisan status quo. It didn't really matter who was in office. We've had Republicans and Democrats in office since the end of the Cold War, all saying the same things about how important it is for America to be the leading power in Asia, and more recently, how important it is to resist China's rise to leadership. And yet, the basic status quo, particularly in military terms, has persisted. You know, American force structure really hasn't changed very much since the end of the Cold War in Asia.
Yeah.
So whether Trump gets in or not, I think it does matter, but because he can accelerate the kind of trends I'm talking about. But I think there are wider issues at play here that go beyond Trump and that will be sustained well beyond Trump. And I think at the heart of it is a basic proposition. How important is Asia for America's security?
Mm.
So the Americans have been able to avoid this question for a long time, because being in Asia, being the leading military power in Asia, hasn't cost very much. But all of a sudden, it's becoming much more costly and much more risky, because you are taking on the second biggest power in the world, which is China.
Mm.
So at long last, America will be forced to confront this question: how important is our leadership in Asia really to America's security? And I think when they're truly forced to confront that question, the obvious answer to me is actually it's not that important. America is an incredibly secure country, and it will remain secure even in the unlikely event that China completely dominates Asia. I don't think that's going to happen. But even if it did, America would still be an incredibly secure place.
Yeah, and this goes to your point earlier about the choices that we make. I mean, if you look at it from Australia's perspective, it's quite a diabolical equation. You've got an increasingly bellicose and expansive China, a bit more aggressive in its rhetoric and its defence build-up and so forth, its capability build-up, and you've got an increasingly isolationist America, which, as you say, whether it's Trump or someone from another Republican, I mean, the Republican Party has become more inward-looking and therefore less inclined to be projecting power here anyway, that you would think in you know, all other things being equal, ought to be encouraging Australia to think about its own resilience, its own sort of the extent, its self-sufficiency to a degree, improving that.
Yeah, and yet the opposite has happened. Mm. We've taken the approach of tying ourselves even more closely to the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. And what just quickly, one final thing, the Tomahawk missiles that we just bought, which, again, not part of AUKUS, but another big defence acquisition, does that change anything?
Well, I mean, for the moment, what we're proposing to do is put Tomahawk cruise missiles on surface ships, the three air warfare destroyers that we built some years ago now. Very advanced vessels, but very capable vessels, except that we are living in an era right now of unprecedented vulnerability for all kinds of major surface ships. So we continue to build them, and in fact every navy in the world continues to build them, whereas the evidence right before our eyes, in fact we saw it again in Ukraine when the Ukrainians sunk the Russian cruiser Moskva.
Mm.
But the evidence for decades now has been that it is incredibly difficult for even the most expensive and well-equipped surface ships to stop advanced cruise missiles and advanced anti-ship missiles, which are incredibly cheap. So we're putting a very advanced missile capability on a vulnerable platform. It might be of some use in sort of marginal contingencies where we're, you know, allied to the United States, much in the same way that the United Kingdom sometimes supplements American forces and strikes, uses cruise missiles for strikes against land targets. But in a China scenario, it's just not relevant anymore because surface ships are so incredibly vulnerable that they will just not be in the fight.
Which goes to the point about submarines, really, isn't it? That they are supposedly undetectable.
Yeah, certainly submarines are a better answer to Australia's defence needs than large surface vessels, that's
and,
for sure.
And you would change that balance?
Yeah. I mean, I think there is definitely a place for surface ships for Australia, but I think they're of much more modest size and capabilities and built mostly for contingencies in our own Pacific Islands region. And really one of the themes of the book is that we ought to be paying much more attention to the Pacific Islands region as part of an Australian sphere of influence. That's mainly a diplomatic task, not a military task, but the military has a role there too.
So that's a security in Asia rather than from Asia sort of
exactly.
Scenario. Right?
Yeah.
And you would presumably Indonesia is a key part of that?
Yeah, so as I said at the beginning, the overarching theme of the book is of distance, of preserving distance.
Mm-hmm.
And one way to do that, I think the primary way of doing that is through our statecraft. And at the core of that has to be one, the Pacific Islands region, and two, Indonesia. We cannot afford to get Indonesia offside. And in fact, the proposal of the book is that we look for a much more intimate and much more ambitious strategic partnership with Indonesia, something akin to a security treaty, effectively, an alliance, although we'd never call it that because the Indonesians don't like that, but something akin to that where as a core shared objective, it would be that effectively to balance Chinese power in maritime Southeast Asia. So the China is never the dominant power.
Doesn't it? But don't such agreements, whether you call them pacts or treaties or whatever, doesn't it sort of run into the same problem, which is that there's mutual obligations. If they have obligations to protect our interest, we have obligations to protect theirs, which means that we are potentially drawn into going for, you know, projecting much further north than you would otherwise advocate.
Well, certainly no further north than maritime Southeast Asia and Indonesia's surrounds. Yeah, so I think at the core of any alliance or any pact of the kind that you're describing has to be a shared objective and shared geography, and that's why Indonesia is such a great partner for Australia, theoretically. I mean, in practice, we're a long way from that. And all the Indonesia specialists who are listening to this podcast and who read my book will say, well, this is fanciful. We're so far away from that. The Indonesians are not nearly ready to involve themselves in a relationship like that. I think that's right. So we've got a lot of work to do.
Right.
But I do think that the two core ingredients for a close strategic partnership are their shared geography and a shared objective. And that objective is really very simple. It's not to be aggressive or expansionist. It's merely to keep maritime Southeast Asia free of foreign domination.
Yeah.
That's all.
Right. And one of the things that that would achieve would be that it would keep at a distance, presumably we were talking a moment ago about platforms from which missiles can be launched, right. Ships. Or submarines, what's China's capability in regard to launching of potentially nuclear warheads from submarines? I understand it's not as far advanced as...
Yeah, well, nuclear weapons are another question again, but you're asking the exact right question, and it is actually remarkable how seldom this question gets asked. So in the Australian debate, it's very common to hear that the danger is on our doorstep or, you know, I think... during the last government, the Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce at one point said we were in danger of being, surrounded by Chinese military capabilities. We are so far from that world. I mean, I've been following China's rise as a military power for most of my career, so I'm not, you know, I'm intimately familiar with what they're capable with. But again, to go back to where we started, projecting military force over long distances is incredibly difficult, and China doesn't have much capability to actually hit Australia. It already has more capability, mind you, than the Soviets ever had. So, of course, the danger is much more acute than it used to be. But still, operating over very long range is very difficult. And so actually the core objective here, as I said, is one of statecraft, is to keep China at a distance through our statecraft.
Mm. Sam Roggeveen, it's been really great having you in the studio to talk about this. It's a courageous book, a really thought-provoking book and essay, and this whole issue does need to have different voices in it. And I think you've made some, you know, fantastically persuasive points here, and I'm really glad to be able to talk to you on Democracy Sausage.
Oh, thank you, Mark. I'm honoured, and thank you for the time.
Pleasure. That's the podcast for this week. I look forward to talking to you again next week. You can get onto us via our email at democracysausage@anu.edu.au and you can give us feedback there. I'm sure some people will have views about this, as Sam Roggeveen's just been saying. He knows he's got plenty of people within the defence and security establishment who'll take issue with some of those points. You may be one of them. Feel free to get in touch with us. We look forward to next week's show. Until then, bye for now.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.